This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code datanauts30. The Datanauts highly distributed, fully redundant, active infrastructure rocket lands in Las Vegas this week for a live recording from VMworld US 2016. Surrounded by everyone who's anyone in the infrastructure space, we are standing smack in the middle of the solutions showcase floor, deep in the gurgling bowels of the Mandalay Bay. And that background noise you hear is not an unruly bunch of meatbots trying to break into the data center to take back their privacy, but rather an unwashed river of humanity shopping the show floor for solutions to the pressing business challenges they hope to solve with IT. I'm Ethan Banks. You can follow me at EC Banks on Twitter. Chris Wall at Chris Wall is right beside me, but only because I bailed him out of a night of bad choices out on the Vegas Strip. And this is the Datanauts podcast. You can find this and all our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, or at packetpushers.net. Joining Chris and I this week is Justin Warren. Justin, would you introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, I'm Justin Warren. I run an analyst and consulting firm called Pivot9, and you can find me on Twitter as at JP Warren.
The big idea today, Datanauts listeners, what is an engineer to do in the changing face of IT? So this happened because I had a conversation earlier this week here at VMworld with someone who was like, what the heck do I go study next? Do I go like learn AWS and maybe do some VMware NSX certifications? Or I mean, everything's changing in IT, so what do I do next? What's the next big thing? And so those are kind of the big ideas we're going to cover today. So I thought we'd start by covering some emerging data center themes, things that we are seeing happen in IT and in the data center. And then we'll talk about what the implications of those are. So let's get your take on this. Would you guys agree with me that Linux is a thing you need to know at this point, kind of no matter what?
Yes and no.
Yeah, well, I'll say this. I don't think there's any operating system that you need to know, because that depends on what you do and where you're doing it and things like that. It seems like there's a lot of advantages to knowing Linux. But certainly, I bleed Microsoft logos. The little window flying things come out of me when I talk. And so, you know, the world of PowerShell and Windows and things like that, for me, is enough to keep my attention occupied. And potentially, if I were working someplace, probably keep me gainfully employed. However, I don't think there's anything wrong with learning Linux. I wouldn't put the required label on it.
Okay. Justin?
I don't think you should be specializing in one or the other anymore. I think that even if you are, say, you're a Linux guy, I'm mostly a Linux and Unix guy. That's my background. But I'm aware of Windows, and I know quite a bit about how that works and how to talk with my Windows friends. So I need to be able to understand what they're talking about when they say things like Active Directory and, I don't know, the bizarre permission system that you have, which allows you to do things that you can't do in Linux. Whereas, because I know Linux, I can then talk to them about what Linux is doing. But there's a lot of crossover these days. I mean, we have PowerShell is now open source, so you can go and run that on things, and you can run SQL Server on Linux now. Now, this is a brave new world.
Yes. Like you said, PowerShell on Linux just recently announced. Chris must get you all tingly.
Well, I would never use it because I run Windows, you know, the best operating. You know, no, it is cool because unlike Python, Ruby, some other things, you could do it everywhere. PowerShell was just on Windows, and that was a big caveat, so I'm glad to see it go other places.
So my point about Linux is just, it's the thing you can't get away from, so if you have no Linux skills, that's probably bad at this point. You should have some basic Linux understanding, as more and more data center infrastructure seems to rely on Linux or have an expectation that there's Linux there somewhere in the mix.
That's that silo busting we tend to harp on. You know, I'm certainly not saying you need to be a master of it, but yeah, you should have a basic understanding how to install it, how it handles bootloading, how it does partitions, basic commands, patch management, all that kind of stuff. It just feels like the full stack engineering journey that we're all trying to go under label. So sure, you should have that level of interest.
So let's expand that full stack engineering journey with automation, which seems to be another hot topic across all the silos. Everybody's got some automation tool flavors, and networking is slowly but surely catching up in that world. Another emerging theme, yeah?
Automate all the things.
I was very lucky. A lot of my sessions, all of them I submitted, got approved. And that's because I was really focusing on PowerShell and automation in general over the last year, and that's been my focus. Okay, apparently a lot of people want to hear about that. So not only are people interested in automation, they want to start deploying it, but that next phase in the automation journey, not only do I want to just make something automatic, I want to make sure that it can remediate itself. So as an example, I'm not just going to look to see if a value is true or false. If it's false, I want it to be true. I'm going to fix that as well. So it's looking and validating infrastructures, turning infrastructures into code, and that kind of SRE world that Google harps on, the site reliability engineering dudes who say, if I find something wrong, I want to auto-heal it because I don't have time to mess around with that. That's the automation that I see people really get that gleam in their eye and a little drool on the side of their mouth. So that's fun for me.
What's fun for me is finding all the Windows guys suddenly discover that, hey, scripting is kind of a thing and it's fun, and clicking next through a GUI is no way to run things at scale. Unix has had this kind of thing for years. So, but that's one of the things that I really like about PowerShell actually being cross-platform now, is that there's a lot of Windows out there. You know, and I, again, from a Linux background, this is all server-centric, but there's a lot of Windows out there. So the fact that you've got a tool that you already know how to use, and if you don't, go learn some, because now you can automate all the things all over the place. And it's the learning how to program and do automation. Of all of the things that you could do, that is the one thing that you need to go do. And it doesn't matter what language you pick. Pick one, pick it up, and go and practice with it, because everything is going to be automated through software.
Okay, so we hit Linux. We hit automation. Now we're going to hit Google infrastructure for everyone else. Giphy. That's how I'm not allowed to pronounce it, Giphy. I will be mocked. So Giphy it is. What do we think about this? We've covered it on Datanauts. If you haven't, go look in the Datanauts audio library and find our show that we did on Giphy. This is an emerging theme, yes or no?
I still think it's one of those things where it's not necessarily like I need to know it for my job today, but man, this is a great time to start investing evening, weekends, whatever time you have to start learning it, reading about it, understanding it so that you're prepared when people really want to start rolling it out. And it, to me, it's just such a great different way to look at IT that's actually fun and exciting and accomplishes a lot of the things we've always wanted to do, like play video games instead of spending our time hitting next finish. Thanks for the snark there, buddy, on that Windows thing. Yes, it's very interesting. I don't think necessarily it's going to be on a job requirement list whole hog yet.
You can count the number of companies with Google scale problems on one finger. So thinking that you need to do everything the way Google does it is the wrong way to go about it. But understanding the principles, like I am a big, big fan of the site reliability engineering book. You go in through there and they're talking about the way that they do things at Google, but in an accessible way, which is all about how you do things at scale. And essentially, you take humans out of the really boring things that humans are not any good at. And you put computers in charge of those. And really, this transition is all about turning IT from a craft industry into a real IT factory.
Yes, craft industry versus factory. I like that a lot. And closely related to that then would be containers. Again, I'm looking at containers and going, I don't think this is transitional. I think this is a place we're going to be parking on for a while as we deploy infrastructure.
The thing about containers, and Docker sort of kicked it off, is that idea is not so new, but the real power of containers has very little to do with the container image itself. It's all around the process of how you deploy things and how you have different layers, and it's automated. That's what's really, really valuable. So going and learning containers to learn that side of the process and the people side of things, far more important than the actual underlying technology, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's more about understanding what it is, how it works, and how can I make that a reality for people that need it. I'm not necessarily going to need containers as an infrastructure person, right? Most of my stuff is hardware, and I'm doing configs and things like that. But I need to provide containers to the business, potentially, and for a lot of folks, they're going to want to do that, or I'm running them for some type of service. So how do I do that? I think that's the good initial set of focus that people should have right now.
Well, it's about teaching people how you can use containers and the whole process flow of things. Again, it's turning IT into a factory. So you have some inputs, I want to do this thing, and you've got this orchestrated pipeline of a way of doing things, which is, okay, so I commit some source code into a repository, it automatically builds everything, runs my entire test suite, and then once that's all done, it takes that artifact and then deploys it into an environment, maybe into production. And then once I've done all of that, then the end user at the end of it has, hey, I just got the thing I wanted, and it didn't take me 7 weeks of procurement and sign-offs and 9 billion layers of process.
Yeah, but I think that's more about CI/CD than it is about containers specifically. I think the challenges right now, everyone is harping on this versus thing, VM versus container versus do I run a bare metal, do I run it on a VM? That's really the smokescreen, I think. I think it's more about, yeah, I want to offer these things as a service. I want to have that deployment model exist. Maybe it's a container, maybe it's a VM. I don't really know right now. It's probably going to be both for a while. But how does that process work? And as an infrastructure ops person, understanding pipelines and how to get stuff from build into production, like really understand it rather than being at the very end between stage and prod, that's where we need to focus our efforts.
I completely agree. And that's why I say that the container and the Docker thing, it's not really about that piece. It's about that pipelining concept. And you can use it for existing infrastructure. You can use those concepts. You don't have to go full.
Closely related to this then is hybrid cloud. So one of the things we're seeing, you can deploy stuff in private cloud, you can deploy stuff in public cloud, hybrid cloud. means you're somewhat agnostic about where you're putting things because it could be driven by cost, it could be driven by performance requirements, and then it's less about the thing, the vehicle, and more about just getting there. But our enterprise is actually going to the hybrid cloud model. It does seem to be that that's where things are settling out.
Absolutely, yes, they are. All of the clients and that I speak to, all my consulting clients, they're all looking at hybrid cloud. They have private cloud now. They have Gmail. They have certain components that will be deployed in a co-location facility. They'll have some stuff that's on site. We've always pretty much done it this way. I like to think of it less as a hybrid cloud and more just multi-site. Some things I store at one site, some things I host at a different site, and they often need to communicate between each other. That's what's important about where you're actually placing things rather than whether or not it's calling it hybrid cloud or not, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the challenge has been, we're all using private data center resources and cloud resources, unless you're some startup or something and you're just all public cloud, but that's true. I think the challenge is that marketing kind of definition of hybrid cloud where it's an overarching infrastructure kind of construct where I can see everything, whether it's on-prem, in cloud, whatnot. I'm treating it all homogeneously no matter where it's at. I can move it around very easily. That's the piece we're not at yet. And that's where I think our earlier discussion on containers and orchestration scheduling type, Kubernetes as an example, would allow you to abstract the underlying cloud, you know, on-prem or whatnot, away from those apps.
Yes.
And make it more fluid. And that's the hybrid cloud we're not at yet.
Yeah, and the real challenge there is that, yes, we can do that for the compute side of things, so Kubernetes and containers. I mean, they're supposed to be ephemeral, so there's no state there. That's a problem because data has mass. Moving it from one cloud to another or from one site to another. You know, I live in Australia, which is on the other side of the world. It took me 25 hours to get here. So the latency of data movement from one country to another one is not insignificant. So, and if you have lots and lots of data, as we're just building more of it, so that means that when we have to move stuff from one site to another, from one cloud to another, that's a problem that no one's really solved yet.
Datanauts has great sponsors that make the show possible. One of them is IT Pro TV. I know you've heard from them before, but based on my review of their site, content, and delivery system, I believe it's a solid certification training platform. There's lots of content there, well over 1,000 hours, and you can consume it any way you want to, including devices like Roku and Apple TV. You can even buy via Amazon Video Direct if that appeals to you. The training material offered is likely what you're looking for. Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE. Check. Certified ethical hacker. Check. Cisco, CCNA security. Absolutely. And lots more. And it's not just training, by the way. IT Pro TV also throws in over 100 labs, as well as Transcenter practice exams, so that you have a pretty good sense of when you're really ready to make an official exam attempt. With IT Pro TV, you don't buy a course. You get access to the entire library via a reasonable monthly subscription. Both individual and group pricing options are available. If you change your mind or cash gets tight, you can cancel with no hassle. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts, use the code DATANAUTS30 and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account. Justin, I want to go back to something you mentioned a little bit ago. I mentioned Giphy, and you said, not a lot of us have Google's problems, or not anybody has Google's problems as such. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Google is enormous. You don't process 700 petabytes of data in 3 hours. It's just not a thing that anybody else does. There are other very large companies, like Facebook is probably one of the closer ones, but they don't have the same scale and breadth of issues that Google does. Most enterprises and the kinds of companies that we're here talking to at VMworld, you are nowhere near that scale. So you don't have to solve the kinds of problems that you have to solve at Google scale. There are qualitative differences when you get to certain levels of scale where what made sense before suddenly stops making any sense at all. And those are some inflection points that aren't immediately obvious if you haven't actually done it before. Google is breaking a lot of new ground because there hasn't been a company that's had to process that much data before. So they're out leading in front. However, what we can do is we can take some of those technologies that they discover and use, and we can use them as enterprises start growing into the size of a company that Google was 10, 15 years ago.
I tend to think on that everyone has Google's problems, but not the problems that are typically associated with Google, the scale stuff. I'm not even really that interested in what is it like to process a million nodes. To me, it's more about not even the technology they do, but the processes, the culture, the human element of IT is interesting. The way that they handle configuration management, the way that they abstract away the state of something from the actual live running of something, that I think every organization out there could definitely follow. Like, we mentioned the SRE book already. To me, I read that, and I was like, yes, this makes so much sense. It was like, I've been to the church of Google. I come back. I love what they're saying. It was so interesting to me that I was like, if I could find a place that did this, I would want to go back to like the end user side of things just to experience this new revolution of IT done right. So I feel like everyone can take a lot of the ideas that they have and use them, with scale being almost negligible.
If you're particularly interested in that, and as I am, I've been preaching this stuff for probably 15 years now.
Because you're a Linux guy, yeah.
Well,
right,
partly,
yeah.
But no, this isn't actually a very new thing. For me, the great analogy that I like to use with all my clients is the Toyota production system. So for those who aren't really aware of what that is, Toyota completely changed the way automobiles were manufactured in about the 1980s by using what they called the Toyota production system, which became lean manufacturing, and it is pretty much used in all manufacturing these days. The analogy works really, really well for the way IT is changing, and a lot of the processes and procedures and tools are very closely reflected in what we see from the Toyota production system in the 80s to what's being done now. You know, Kanban boards came from that. So if you're interested in that and you know, enjoy the Google SRE book, I'd encourage reading a book called The Goal, by Elliot Goldratt, which is a nice encapsulation. You've probably read a variant of it, which is called The Phoenix Project, which is basically some IT people who went and rewrote The Goal, but used a whole lot of IT analogies to make it easier to understand. But yeah, go and dig into that. Jump onto Wikipedia and read up on the Toyota production system, and it will start you down a very interesting rabbit hole. You'll learn a lot. Those are the sorts of processes and procedures that's what Google's doing, and that's what a lot of modern enterprises are doing. So yes, absolutely, go do that.
I'll put out a plug for the Phoenix Project. It is very easy to read, but it takes you through a scenario within a company that is desperately inefficient and needs to be competitive. They need to change their processes. And it's again, easy to read, and it takes you step by step by step through how they transform their business internally. It's not entirely realistic, I don't think, because of the speed at which the book moves. You're going, okay, we can never get this done this fast, but it really is a logical process set. And it was a cheap book, whatever it was. I put it on my Kindle. I think it might have been $9.99 or something.
Whatever the price is, it's totally worth it.
It's totally worth it, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the issues with it is a bit of a toy problem, and there are a couple of key issues in there that they kind of gloss over. That's sort of the more advanced class. But hey, it's a book, and it's a start. That's not where you end. This is the beginning of your learning.
Another point I want to make here is we consider real-world implications. You know, we talked about Giphy, and we don't all have Google's problems, but that doesn't mean it doesn't impact us. There's still lots of impact that can be had. Another consideration here is automation. If we're doing a lot of automation, depending on what we are defining as automation and what tools we're using, we are abstracting away a lot of the underlying infrastructure, and we are abstracting away a lot of the processes that are happening, things that we used to do by hand, and as infrastructure engineers being very intimately familiar with either CLI commands or point-and-click things that we were doing. And Justin, I think you described it as kind of the boring stuff that, why wouldn't we automate this? It's just, we don't need a human to do these things, you know, make them go away. But I want to stress that, to me, abstraction doesn't mean simplicity. It's actually the opposite. It's more simple to use, but it's actually more complex what's happening underneath.
Underneath it is very complex. So a nice analogy is, like, I learned how to program in assembler. Also C, but assembler. If you look at the kind of things that a modern C compiler does to generate assembler, a human can't do that. Like, the level of optimization of the way it does loops and other bits and pieces to deal with modern processes is completely different to the kind of handcrafting of assembler that you would do. But we don't program in assembler anymore, or only in very, very specialized cases, because we've abstracted away. We're using higher-level languages like PowerShell and Python.
Yeah, you move to Python, and it's even higher than C. What's going on there?
That's right. And you don't need to understand some of the details about how things like flash memory, for example. There are entire computers involved in flash storage systems just to figure out whether or not the flash cell is a 0 or a 1. But you don't have to touch any of that. It just works in the background. Okay. It's incredibly hard to do, though.
Okay, so some of that stuff just works. These embedded systems, things that we don't see. But I think with IT and infrastructure management and automation, there's a concern here that, yes, it is powerful what's happening, and in theory, we never have to look at it. But some of this stuff's going to break because there's so many moving parts, and that's an opportunity for infrastructure engineers. We're not just going to be people that run the script and things happen, we're going to also need to be the people that understand how that system works so that when things aren't deploying properly, when things aren't working, we can troubleshoot that system, that automation system. Would you agree with that, or am I kidding myself?
It's always good to have a manual override. And it's covered in the Google SRE book as well, in that if you get too used to just using the tools that you normally use, the automation tools, if they stop working, suddenly you can't do your job. So it's always wise to be, it's like, I can use a spray gun or something to paint the walls of stuff, but I can still pick up a paintbrush and paint it by hand if I have to. So you need to stay practiced on certain other more manual ways of doing things for those few circumstances when things break.
I remember when I started working with NSX, it was the biggest moment where what you're saying, Ethan, resonates with me. I remember very easy to deploy, very easy to consume and to configure. But once there was an issue, like I can't get from host A to host B, it's like, wow, now there's seven more layers of stuff I have to go through to configure and troubleshoot even before I even get to the physical land. And it was learning all these troubleshooting tools, learning how to like get data out of the system, where day-to-day, yeah, this stuff's easy, deploy it, everything just works great. When something breaks, it's all of a sudden like, whoa, I have this whole new layer of abstraction to troubleshoot. It took me a little while, personally, as an engineer, to get through that. So it definitely takes a bit.
Okay, let me phrase this question subtly differently. We've been looking at it from an engineer perspective, but how's a business going to look at this? They're going to say, I just got VMware CrossCloud, one of the things that was announced here at VMworld, that lets me put a workload in any cloud that is in that ecosystem, and it's all just basically push button, you drag and drop kind of stuff. So I don't need to have an engineer anymore because magic software takes care of it for me. I mean, does that seem like a wise choice for a business?
I don't think there's magic software there. I know that's marketing. I think what it is, though, is taking a step back from what you just said. We didn't have the tools to do a lot of that stuff in the past. We didn't have APIs at the infrastructure level, and we didn't talk to APIs as infrastructure ops commonly. We used specific protocols, specific processes, command line. Now we need engineers that can talk that kind of language and can orchestrate across the cross-cloud thing as an idea, right? How do I actually make that useful? Just putting in the platform is largely meaningless. How do I actually operationalize that, make sure it's running, monitor it, get metrics out of it, heal it, write all the code that's going to surround it, that kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of value, different layers for the operational engineer or the infrastructure engineer that aren't the command config, you know, the imperative type configs. It's more about declarative type of configs and operating that very complex abstracted entity.
I'll use an analogy to a different industry, either maybe automobile or actually plumbing, I think. So as a business, I have buildings, like, and I either rent them or I live in them, and most of the time they work. But when they don't, I need to call a plumber to come and fix my toilet. And yep. I know, and it's really, really important to me when the toilet stops working. But most of the time it's fine. So I don't actually have to have a toilet engineer on staff. I can rent one. Or if my car stops working, I can take it to be serviced by an engineer. It's their job to understand how the car works. So you as an IT engineer, it's your job to understand the complexities so that when a customer comes to you with a broken car, you can fix it quickly and affordably and then give it back to them and they can get on with doing what they want to do. Me as a person who, like, I own a car, I don't want to fix my car. I don't care. I just want to drive it. So as a business person, I just want to be able to drive my business. It's your job to make sure that my car works.
So if I'm a business person making that staffing decision for IT, do I, for the most part, rely on the software and then bring in a consultant to be my mechanic, if you will, to fix things when they're broken?
It depends on what you're using your car for. So, for example, if I'm heavily reliant on transport to, say, move stuff around, then I'm going to be a lot more sensitive to when it breaks. So I'm more likely to have someone on staff to make sure that they know exactly how my car needs to work for my circumstances. But if it's something like, for example, email, I'm not going to have an email guy on staff. I'm just going to use Gmail or Office 365.
Exactly, exactly. All right, another implication for the real world here are silos. Now, the IT stack, there's been a lot of convergence. There's been a lot of interdependency. When I stand up an app, I'm standing up all of the infrastructure that that app relies upon to work, and that functionality is coming together. It's not, well, okay, so it is, as we talk to different businesses, still siloed. There's still the network guy and the security person and the storage chick and on and on. Siloed, the way IT infrastructure is growing, we're seeing the needs for the silos to come down, and it seems like they're going to eventually. Maybe that's happening a little bit slowly. My point being, ultimately here as an engineer, we've had deep specialties. I'm really good at networking. Now you kind of need to be really good at that and other things too. Is that fair?
I think that it should have always been that way, but I mean, throughout history, specialization is very, very useful. So if I have to do everything, that's actually not very efficient because, like, I don't make my own clothes. I don't grow my own wheat. it is important to have specialties so that someone can do that very, very well. However, being able to interface with other people in the outside world is really important as well, because otherwise they can't understand the value that you provide.
So it's also very helpful as an IT professional to understand the whole system. Application delivery not being just your silo, it's across silo. Okay, if you know as a network person, you've been asked to troubleshoot this problem and you look at it from the networking way, it's kind of helpful to know how that application works so that you can go, well, it isn't the network. I think it might be the app because I've had some experience here, and here are the reasons, based on my experience with this application, what might be going wrong, and you bring in some other people to help. If you're a person that can facilitate those cross-silo conversations, you're incredibly valuable to the business.
There's enterprise architecture is sort of a role that exists in many enterprises, and that's part of their function, is that they once were a technical specialist often, but then they gradually become more broadly skilled in a lot of different technologies. I mean, I know quite a lot about a lot of different technologies, but I'm not a networking specialist, not anymore, because I'm just not up to date on the latest technology. But I know enough about it, and it hasn't changed that much in 10 years, that I can have a good conversation with someone about networks.
Yeah, and I just want to comment that the two main challenges, you mentioned the silos breaking down. I think we both feel they're breaking down a little slower than we would like. Well, A, it's a people change. That's tough.
Yes.
You know, you need people to get more skills, and you need their managers to allow them to get more skills and pay for that. And the business needs to see the value from that. And B, they already have a complex IT infrastructure with politics and all these other things going on. It's harder to say, well, we want to change everything, and everything that you knew, what we hired you for, is now changing. That's a tough political battle. It can be tough with human resources to actually approve that sort of thing. I mean, it's a sticky mess to try to fix. You need everyone kind of on board and motivated and energized to do it. So it's more than just saying I'm a network engineer and I want to become more storage or virtualization focused. There needs to be kind of a push behind that, especially coming from kind of top down, I think.
Yeah, I like to say everything is a people problem.
So as we bring this show to an end, what we're going to talk about now, you want to know as a listener, what should I be focusing on? What skills should I be acquiring? Some of this maybe you're going to be able to guess based on our earlier conversation, but we're going to go rapid fire through several things. Let's start with this, guys. Containers and scheduling. If I'm a larger shop, should I be really wrapping my brain around that?
Yep. Go learn how to use Kubernetes.
I don't see any reason not to. It seems like it has a lot of value. It gives that cross-cloud kind of enablement, abstracts away, that sort of stuff. And it's super cool. I mean, it's a lot of fun to learn and use. So definitely yes.
You said Kubernetes. You did not say Mesos or Mesosphere.
My feel and my read on things is that Kubernetes seems to have a critical mass of mind share. So it feels like Kubernetes is going to win out.
You also didn't say Swarm.
Correct.
Wow.
Okay, skill two, hyperconvergence. And in this context, I'm thinking more smaller shops.
Small shop, yep, it's fine. Remote office, branch office, it's fine. Data center, nope.
I feel like hyperconvergence offers some values if you're very legacy and you're trying to get out of that bucket. So I think it can offer some value. At really, really large scale, I question whether or not doing more of a Giphy type architecture wouldn't make more sense. But ultimately, it's going to be driven by budget and how much you have and what you want to spend, I think.
Okay, here's a third one. Deeply integrated vendor stacks. And by this, I guess I'm kind of talking about hyperconvergence again. But my point is, if I've got EMC and VMware, I can make a very tightly integrated stack. If I'm Cisco, I've got all these different pieces and parts that I can put a very unified stack with. They've got UCS and networking, etc. If I'm HPE, I can do the same kind of thing. Would you invest in that sort of a vendor ecosystem?
Personally, no, but I know that there are customers who it may suit. There's a whole process that you'd have to run through. So if you want to talk typical integrated stack, that's the likes of Oracle and IBM. They will sell you everything, soup to nuts, storage all the way through to software on the total stack, and you have one person to yell at when everything is broken, but you have to believe in that ecosystem because you are going to be locked into that thing for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I think if you have the spaghetti architecture that's been just rotting in the data center for years, it's a great middle step between what I feel like is the next gen of IT, where we're not relying on any integrated stacks. It's more abstracted stacks. But if you've got a mess, it's a nice, clean way to kind of clean it up. It's an easy way to cut a PO, and your architecture does not look like crap anymore. So it can have some value.
All right. Number four, open source projects. I'll specifically name, well, let's start with OpenStack, which is kind of under some fire here lately.
OpenStack is all, everyone loves to hate on OpenStack. I think that it will be like open source. It will be everywhere. You won't even notice. And then suddenly we'll wake up one day and go, oh, wow, they won.
I don't have too much of an opinion on it. It seems like a good idea. It seems like the hardest part is still implementing it. And that seems solvable to me. And it's a good alternative to some other products that are out there at a higher cost point. So it feels like, yes, it's going to be interesting and continue to remain relevant long enough to make it on this podcast anyways.
And is Kubernetes just hot right now? And it's going to be, 6 months from now, we're like, oh, remember when Kubernetes was like the thing? Or is that software really got enough momentum for the right reasons that it's going to have longevity?
My impression from people who really know how to use it well is that it's got a little bit of a steep learning curve to begin with, and that's where Docker is quite popular. It's easy to onboard. But once you start hitting some of the issues that it actually matters at scale, the engineering thought that's gone into Kubernetes, it shows the Google heritage of, we've done this at really large scale and we know why this is important. Trust us, you are going to hit this and this is the right way to solve this problem.
Seems to be the vibe that I'm getting from it as well. Folks that are using it like it. And there is even, when I said OpenStack coming under fire, what I was actually getting at is there's been some blog posts and so on about Kubernetes and containers actually replacing OpenStack wholesale. So it's something to keep an eye on. One other company I'll mention in the context of open source is Red Hat. Now, Red Hat has a lot of enterprise products that you can buy and pay for, etc. But they are also deeply involved in a great number of open source projects. And if you follow their blog, you can get an incredible amount of information about what's going on at a very beyond detailed level. Some of the blogs that they're putting out are actually white papers, or should be, because they are so heavy duty.
Yeah, I was just talking with Red Hat recently about some of their container vision, and they have had a lot more to do with it than you might realize. So yeah, definitely go and spend some time looking at what Red Hat have got to say. They really know what's going on.
Yeah, see, positive things to me, they got Brian Gracely recently, was a guest on our show. And if they're attracting talent like that, there's something interesting going on there. The other one, Ansible, that's something I've enjoyed for a very long time, and to see that within their hands, it's like, all right, they understand the value of a solid config management tool. So I'm positive towards them.
Public cloud. And by public cloud, I'm talking, there's a lot of variations of what that is out there. It's not just Amazon or Azure. It's a whole bunch. Is that a skill set I want to throw into my arsenal?
Yes.
Now, would you pick on Amazon and say, so go learn AWS, or would you keep it broad?
I would learn AWS. I would definitely learn Azure as well. My impression is that Azure is more likely to succeed with enterprise because Microsoft knows developers to start with. They also really know enterprise. They have AD. They have email. And they also have a lot of money.
I was going to say, I actually feel like starting with AWS feels a little more relevant right now. They've got a pretty decent certification program for system admins and things like that. And it's everywhere. And at the same time, once you learn AWS, I feel like there's a lot of transferable skills towards the world of Azure, especially because I feel like a lot of the Azure stuff is the application kind of SaaS offerings, not necessarily anything that's totally outside of the realm of what you learn in the AWS world anyway. But yes, they're both very important. Definitely learn them at the very least the introductory level. Check out those certs.
And I think a point to make about public cloud is they're not all the same offering. They all have the root value proposition is the same, but the way they operate and their specific details cater to different problems. And so you may need to evaluate public clouds individually, looking at what problem am I trying to solve and see which public cloud fits. It was interesting here at VMworld to hear in the keynote, VMware did a large survey of enterprises and found that the average enterprise was consuming 8 different public clouds, on average, 8. So maybe whether that's your company or not, I don't know. And that's not all infrastructure as a service. That was also SaaS. But still, the point stands, different clouds solving different problems. And so it's worth getting a broader skill set there. All right, guys, last question. You mentioned certifications a minute ago, Chris. Would you bother getting certified in anything particularly?
I've always felt certifications are a great learning path. If you're trying to learn something that a vendor has, the certification is designed to make that possible. Now, there's always a marketing and sales slant to it. They want you to know, like the Cisco stuff I took had products I had never heard of and don't care about, but I had to learn them for the cert. Great, take that as a grain of salt, put it aside. But by and large, the 50, 60 some odd different certs I've gotten taught me a lot about things I would never would have thought of. Microsoft was a great example. So the entry-level certs for AWS and Azure, totally worth it. I would take them. They're cheap. There's some stuff on the V Brown bag where they're actually covered in depth. There's a lot of actual sandboxes available from those public cloud vendors where you can play with them. There's really no reason not to do it. So I would do it. In fact, I'm planning to do it myself. So for sure.
Yeah, I can. There is value in certifications. I've done some myself in the past. I think you, for an earlier stage of your career, there's more value in them. As your career sort of moves on, and if you're getting up to sort of the architecture level, there's less value in specific certifications. But again, that just goes back to saying, well, look, I'm no longer a deep technical specialist in one specific area, and that's where certifications really help you prove out that, A, I actually know what I think I know, because you get tested on it. But when you have a much more broad range of things, then it becomes, well, now I have to certify in 800 different things simultaneously, and it just becomes too difficult to manage.
Yep, I have nothing to add to the certifications. I've written on a lot of this stuff, and you guys are echoing my opinions very strongly. And since all three of us have places to be here at VMworld, we've got busy schedules, let's wrap up the show here. And as we do that, let's go around the table. And if you would, just tell everybody how they can follow you on the internet, starting with Justin.
Sure, it's Justin Warren. You can find me on Twitter at JPWarren, and you can read my blog. It's eigenmagic.com. And if you really want to get my professional opinion on stuff, come and check out the company at pivot9.com.
And please follow him on Twitter. The snark is astonishing. It's very entertaining feed.
It's deep and thick, yeah. And I'm Chris Wall. I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitters. Wallnetwork.com is my blog. And definitely hit me up on the Twitters. I'm GitHub at Chris Wall as well.
And that is it for today's edition of the Datanauts Podcast. I am Ethan Banks. You can reach me at EC Banks, and my blog is ethancbanks.com. And by the way, Chris has told me he'd really appreciate it if you try all your zero-day exploits against his site. He really likes to test his disaster recovery processes as often as possible. And for more of our Datanauts shows about infrastructure engineering, deep dive into the ocean that is packetpushers.net, you'll find the Datanauts talking about containers, conferences, certifications, PowerShell, moving to cloud, full-stack engineering, storage architecture, and so much more with infrastructure experts from around the world. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Zero day.
Just make sure your switches on your mic stay on, guys.
I only know how to switch them on.
Of course you do.